Talk on homework. If you haven't noticed, there's about a month left, roughly, before your first midterm project, major midterm project is due. And so I would encourage you, probably within the next week, you want to pin down which options you're going to choose. So you can be spending time looking over the Old Testament passages, the New Testament passages, seeing how those Old Testament passages fit into the message of that Old Testament book, and then how the New Testament writer takes those passages as the hooks that he's going to link onto and pull the message from the Old Testament into the New Testament, and perhaps even cast it beyond the New Testament to the return of Christ. So that's kind of the nature of the assignment, but you want to start making your choices and getting your mind around how you're going to approach that project pretty quickly so that you have time to think through it and work through it. Also, kind of your daily or weekly regimen is the journals. And I think what I've said and what is written in the syllabus could be confusing. One, because I can't do math on the fly. And so if you were thinking 48 journal entries, there should actually only be 44 because of the 12 weeks, you didn't get any advance warning for week one. So I've got to knock a week off. So there's actually should be 44 journals. But then just bear in mind, the idea of the journals is really for you and the Lord. I believe that in having to write and put down on paper your reflections, think of it like a piece of hard candy, you're savoring the reality and truth of God in the Scriptures by taking pen to paper 4 days a week is something that should reward and nourish you. I don't plan to read all 44 of your entries. I probably won't even read but maybe one of them, and then I'm just going to count. So those are for you. They are really something that I think will be a sweet treasure for you to come back to, maybe even down the road, and see what God was teaching you and showing you throughout this class. All right? So don't get too concerned about me meticulously grading those journals. Those are really for you, but it's to guide you and get you going on a process of journaling that I believe will be a great benefit to your soul and in your devotional life with the Lord, not just in this class, but from now on, because it's something that doesn't take a ton of time, but I believe has great spiritual benefit for you. So that's kind of the idea of the journals. This isn't like college where I'm going to put A, B, C, D on those at all. Make sense? All right. So those are the assignments. Just wanted to make a brief mention of that. Now, here's what I'd like to do as we get started. I'd like to take just a few minutes because, again, once I get this plane up in the air, right, you're just going to be hanging on for dear life. So I want to get you interacting a little bit. What are some things that you have been seeing? We've covered Genesis and Exodus thus far. So this is a question that's kind of reflecting back on where we've been. But in that process, it'll help us get ready for where we're going to go in class tonight. What are some of the things that have really stood out to you going through Genesis and Exodus and this early part of the story thus far? What are some of the highlights that you're taking away that God's showing you through these first couple classes together? Just picture me pretending to sip my coffee at this point. Come on, somebody be bold. This is your chance to encourage one another.
Well, listening to the class isn't quite the same. When you were talking about, okay, that was the last week. But anyways, talking about Noah and how things had already gotten so bad to that point where God was going to destroy everybody and he picks the best person, like you were saying, and starts over, and not within a few years, all of a sudden things are all bad again. And considering how quickly we are, I hadn't thought about the story that way before. It was another example of how quickly we can turn away from God, which I think is a recurring theme.
Hmm. Yeah, because I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this, but I can remember two very vivid transitions in my life where I thought, oh yeah, this is the chance for a fresh start and I'm going to do it different this time. One, going off to college, right? So any baggage that I had from high school, things that I thought needed to be changed in my life, I thought surely when I go to college, this will be the time where I'm going to learn to walk with God the right way. And I don't think it lasted very long. I can't remember if it was hours or days before some of those same things just carried right on along. And then the same story kind of repeated itself. So kind of like Judges tonight, right? The cycle repeated itself because I got ready to graduate from college and it's like, oh yeah, I'm moving to Peoria. I don't know anybody there. Surely this will be the chance to really learn what it means to walk with God. And that didn't go so well the first year or so either. And so there is a sense in which we see that pattern repeated in our own lives today. Great. What other things are standing out to you in this story?
I think you see God's relationship to man. Mm-hmm. How man is just love and destroy inside. He's the one who wants the relationship.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that if God is not the active agent in the relationship, this thing is going to crumble. Yeah. What else?
I would say seeing how God makes things or allows things to be difficult to better show his glory.
Hmm. Yeah, that difficult from our perspective is something to be avoided, whereas difficult from God's perspective tends to accomplish all the more what he's about. Sounds like a conversation I had with my daughter this morning. Monday's always a rough day in the world of homeschooling, especially when you're coming off of Super Bowl Sunday and all of this, right? Because now it's like time to get back to work. And so I don't even think it was like 15 minutes before we got into the tears and the, there's so much work to do today. To which I was like, you know what, sweetie? You and I are in the same boat today. You know, the Super Bowl last night cost me 3 hours of preparation for my lesson today. And so I'm going to be in the same battle for joy in the work that God entrusts to us for this whole day. So, and yet those difficult things are the things that God most uses to teach us dependence and when we're dependent, then his glory shines through us. Good. What else?
The sovereignty of God and just how he doesn't need us to accomplish his purposes.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You can't read these books and not be humbled. But one, that God would draw us into the story in the first place, but two, that he does and how he does, and to Andy's point, how he continues to sustain and grow that relationship.
Also, you pointed out last week how there's kind of a specific order to how God works. Like, not that we can figure out God's going to do things a certain way, but his graciousness in, like, revealing himself, and then not until he's revealed himself and drawn his people in, then does he, like in the example that he gave last week, then he gives the law. And the law is gracious because the law helps his people to see their relationship to him and his expectations as representatives of who he is.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's excellent. And so if we take that, right, we take the point about sovereignty, and then we take this gracious, sequential, very strategic plan of God that we're seeing unfolded very clearly, very prominently at the start of the story. And those themes aren't going to get weaker as the story runs along. But how do those two things really guide us and help us as we look at our own lives? Because I think those things are huge, and yet they're easy to lose sight of in our own lives. So if you think about that, the sovereign plan and purposes of God, but also that there's a sequence and a timing, and that everything that he's doing is linked. How does that help you in the battles that you face in life? Yeah, good. Other things. Has there been, maybe even you to have a testimony of a time in your life where if you just looked at the circumstances, you just looked at it from the outside, it's like, man, what in the world is going on here? And then it's years, you know, for us, right, it's usually years later, and I believe there's, John Piper had a great statement in a blog not too long ago, you know, God's doing like 10,000 things in your life right now, and you're maybe aware of three of them. Where or when was a time in your life where you were really struggling, and you can look back now and you can see how God was working this sovereign plan and was actually orchestrating things in a sequence that's, you look back now and you're like, wow, I would have never planned it that way, but that is amazing. Do you have a testimony that you want to share? You may not, but I suspect you do. Because I want to encourage you that these aren't Aesop's fables or tales that just happen to super special people. That God records these and reveals these to us to remind us and draw us into the story that he's still writing and weaving today in our lives in similar fashion to the way he's doing in the lives of Abraham and Moses and Joshua and Ruth, as we'll see today. Come on, I know they're there. Come on, you guys are cool. If you give the reins over, I mean...
My sisters were both very mission focused, but I really just wanted to work in an event center, you know, do the whole, like, here's a lot of money, here's what you do with money, that type of thing. But God closed a lot of doors in the one where he kept opening with ministry. But that was, I mean, it was just kind of like, that's not what you wanted to do. And at that point in time, it was like, do I really want to go back to Peoria? Do I really want to? I mean, there's just so many things that once you've been away from home, once you've done other things and you have your mind set on something, it's like, okay, but obviously God doesn't want any of this to work out. Like, I had the experience, I had the grades. So, I mean, but look, I mean, I'm in a job that I love. I've been there for over 7 years now. I mean, like, that's not ever something that I would have planned. And just, like, the community that I have, the church family that I have, I see my sister who lives away from home and how hard it is to not be at home. And I'm very blessed that even though, like, I have to see my parents a week, but, I mean, I can go see them tomorrow if I want. You know what I mean? Just the blessing of that. And how when you first graduate, like, you don't see all of that.
That's right.
Go somewhere else, it's really hard to find the same thing, and just the blessing of that and not having to go through that for like my own church.
Yeah.
So just like the different areas that, I mean, you can just see, okay, well, obviously I just want to end up here, but God has blessed all of those areas.
Hmm. Yeah, there's like this amazing connect the dots that's going on that, you know, it's not like the ones for my kids where you can kind of see what the shape of the thing is. For God, though, that's what it's like. But it's, you don't realize how one situation, one decision, one set of choices has this whole panoramic effect that God is orchestrating and weaving into a beautiful picture, just like you shared, that affects family life, spiritual life, community of faith life, all of that. Great. Thanks, Carrie. Anyone else? Any other testimonies of how you've seen that?
I have one. Well, it's a little personal, but more so about my family. But my sister was dating a guy, actually one of Tim's really good friends, and she got pregnant by someone else. And it was obviously really devastating for everyone. But Scott, her boyfriend, forgave her, pursued. I mean, they went through counseling. Just amazing things that at the beginning it was so devastating and we were right in the middle of it. And so it was really hard to even know what to say or, you know, being like, God, what is going on? Like, how would this happen of all the times, you know? He was talking about proposing to her and all this stuff. And anyways, several months later, he did propose. They did get married just this last year, and Grace is their daughter, you know, and the testimony it has been to our family, seeing my sister grow in ways that I don't know how it would have happened otherwise, you know. At the time, it was awful, but I am very thankful, and, you know, there is a life there, and we have no idea what will happen with Grace as she gets older. And the testimony that is, but my brother, who's not a believer, you know, when he found out that Scott was going to stick with her and work on this and all this stuff, he was just like, what? You know, so it just goes out even further than the family, you know, to people on the fringes who you don't even know what it's going to mean or do to see someone love and forgive the way God does and show grace. So, and it was good for us, too, because we learned how to work on, not necessarily counseling, but, you know, what to say to people or how to help them work through obvious conflict and stuff like that. So at the time, it was terrible.
Grace, good idea what to say.
Yeah. You know, and looking back, Grace is 7 months old now, and, you know, it's just amazing how God does stuff that you don't even know. How you didn't explain or even, you know, you hope for something like that to happen, but never would you really think that it could turn out even better, you know, so.
No, that's right.
It's just been the last 2 years for us, but.
Yeah, it's a great reminder that God isn't simply working with those that are obedient to him and loving him. In fact, God isn't limited to only working with those, as we saw with the story of Joseph, right? God is able to plant his people, this family, right in the heart of the most powerful nation, in the palace of the most powerful nation, because of the wicked, evil, and actions of some pretty jealous brothers toward their little brother and the dream that he had. And in the end of it, right, you see this powerful transformation. I didn't share this last week, so this will be a little free tidbit for this week, right? But one of my favorite elements that's often overlooked in that story of Joseph is Judah. Because Judah is the ringleader that actually gets the traitors, sells Joseph, concocts the plan to get him to Egypt. He wants him dead, done, gone. And who's the one at the end of the story that says, you know what, Benjamin's in prison, my life for his. Because I don't want to see my father go through this again. My life for his, right? Which is a powerful picture of substitution.
that is a key theme we're going to see again tonight. And so Judah has this remarkable transformation in his life from the ringleader to the one who's offering his life, his freedom, his everything to see someone else go free. He takes the punishment for his brothers. Powerful, powerful picture. And we see that. I see that in my own life. You know, how is it that God orchestrated that I would be standing here tonight teaching a class here? Well, my parents were not the most well off, so that back in the day when I wanted to get Shaquille O'Neal pump shoes, you know, the ones where they had the little basketball and you could like pump them up and then could bleed the air off of these basketball shoes, I had to get jobs and all this. So I decided that I wanted to be a millionaire by the time I was 50. And in college, they taught us how. And so, I mean, it was pretty simple, right? Save 10% of your salary and get 10% rate of return and it'll happen. And so I'm like, all right, in engineering, Caterpillar, pretty stable company, right? So I'm looking for longevity, looking for a salary that'll probably grow over my career that would allow me to save 10%. And they have a pretty good plan for investments and whatnot, so I can probably make 10%. Here we go. Boom. That's why I came to Peoria, right? No spiritual magic to that whatsoever. It was solely a good job and make a lot of money and then go play a lot of golf by the time I'm 50 or 55. That's Matt's plan, right? But here's God using horrible motives on my part to accomplish a totally different plan. Far more glorious plan. An easy plan? No. But a glorious one for God's purposes, yes. All right. So tonight, I want you guys to be thinking about that. Each week, I want to try and have you thinking about how the story that God is writing in your life connects into this story that we're seeing in the Scriptures. Because though this book is closed in one sense, God is not continuing to reveal more books of the Bible. It is not closed in the sense that God has not finished the work that He's promised and declared He will finish. And we are part of that work that is still ongoing and awaiting consummation and its fulfillment. So don't ever lose sight of seeing how your life connects into the things that we're going to talk about each week. Well, tonight we're going to start, not really start, we're going to wrap up this look at the wandering in the wilderness. And so the first session tonight is the way of the wilderness. And really, we're going to look at the difficult path to the promise. God had promised Abraham land, seed, blessing. The seed Abraham saw in his lifetime, that was Isaac. And so the seed that Genesis 3:15 spoke of, this descendant, this child of Eve that would one day crush the serpent's head, is picked up in Abraham, one who, according to the Scriptures, is as good as dead in terms of being able to reproduce and create offspring. His wife, same condition. And yet the sovereign hand of God opens her womb, and the seed now is transferred and begun in Isaac. And so God fulfills that portion of the promise, although that fulfillment of the promise isn't the ultimate fulfillment. It's still looking ahead to that seed that Genesis 3:15 spoke of that would do fatal damage to sin, death, and that serpent back in the garden. And so God had fulfilled that in Isaac for Abraham, but that's about it. I mean, Abraham ends his life and he has not realized land. He has not realized descendants as numerous as the stars. He's got one child. That's it. And the nations aren't really impacted by the story of this man. I mean, I guess you could say they're impacted because he goes and lies twice about his wife being his sister. I don't know that that's exactly the testimony, though God is glorified in that, right? Because God protects and preserves their lives and also makes crystal clear that he's in control even of Pharaoh and the other king that Abraham is confronted with. And then we see how God, through the continuation of that promise in not only Isaac, but then Jacob, plants a family of 70 in Egypt. And this family of 70 is now in Egypt. And as I was sharing last time, this is amazing, right? God's Miracle-Gro for his glory is suffering and persecution. And so what better way to get like the most potent Miracle-Gro you can imagine than to put your people, this family of 70, in the heart of the most powerful nation. And not just that, but as this people grows, right, and the more Egypt tries to oppress Israel, the more they multiply, the stronger they become, to the point where Pharaoh says, let's just kill all the babies, right? And so let's just up the oppression all the way, to which God says, great, this will be my vehicle to get the leader for my people into the palace. It's not enough just to get into the land and be generally present in Egypt. I want the palace. And so he plants Moses in the palace as a precursor to leading his people and delivering them from slavery, bondage, and oppression. And saw these beautiful pictures of God hearing the cry of affliction of his people, remembering the promises that he's made, and delivering big time. We talked about his gracious revelation that upon delivering his people and setting them free in the wilderness, he's going to personally dwell among them, which means that with a holy God in their midst, there needs to be some defining of the relationship. And the law given at Mount Sinai is the terms that define this relationship between a holy God and a delivered, redeemed people. And so that's kind of where we left our story last time. Tonight, we're going to continue on in this wilderness journey. 40 years, the people of Israel are going to turn this way and that way until they finally reach the land. So God promised Abraham again, land, seed, and a blessing, that they would reach the nations, be a testimony of his glory to the nations. The seed now has multiplied. They are literally as numerous as the stars. They're abundantly prosperous in that regard. But there's no land. They're nomads out in the wilderness. How is God going to accomplish that element of the promise? Well, this is no easy road, right? Jesus later on would say, broad is the road that leads to destruction. Narrow is the way that leads to life. Well, guess what? In the wilderness, we see just how difficult the path to receiving, enjoying, savoring the promised provision and rest of God can be. And that's what we're going to see particularly here in Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So here's a recap. We have from Adam to Abraham, and now to Moses, God's appointed leader, and his gracious revelation at Mount Sinai. And so tonight we're going to finish off this historical preview that really details and chronicles the history of God's sovereign formation, establishment, and placement of a special people, a nation that is his own special possession in the land. When we land and end tonight, didn't mean to double use land there, but when we finish tonight, they are in the land, the nation is established, and we're asking ourselves, who is going to rule this people? And we get the first glimpse. Again, remember that picture of a fogged or a frosted windshield, right? In Ruth, we get just an eye hole opening through the fog of how God is going to rule and lead his people that will become the pattern and the pointer toward the Messiah that he will bring later in the story. So, looking at the way to the wilderness from a different perspective, here's the big picture, because I want you to see this story in context. We have creation, fall, and we have the family, and this is a family that starts with one man. God looks at all the nations scattered, different languages. He chooses one man. He blesses Abraham. He calls him to leave his family, and to trust God and his promises. And so Abraham does that, and that is passed to Isaac, to Jacob, and then through Joseph, this family lands in Egypt, and it's in Egypt under suffering and persecution that a family turns into a people. They multiply, they are abundantly prosperous, fulfilling God's creative design back in Genesis 1. And then God delivers them gloriously, sovereignly, powerfully, and now they're going to wander. Wander, 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 and there's this period of wandering that sets the stage for them inheriting the land and the promises that God had made to Abraham. So here's another way of thinking about the story thus far. There's the promised blessing where God is the initiator. Abraham has done nothing to deserve this. God promises things, and he's going to deliver them. But then there's the propagation of the promise, that God doesn't just leave it with Abraham so that the promise is only valid and alive for Abraham. No, it's ongoing, and it lives through Abraham's descendants. But then there is the punctuation of the promise with God's personal presence. And this is what we saw last time in the deliverance out of Egypt and slavery and bondage. God's people are helpless, and God comes in as the powerful deliverer and rescuer for his people. And then, after delivering and rescuing them, he establishes graciously his rule and reign in relationship. So, tonight then, we take that part of the story, and we saw last time this idea of God's blessing, God affirming, committing himself in covenant love to Abram, but that covenant love is tested, right? There is a faith response that God is going to test his chosen instruments. He's going to test their faith. And so we see that in the birth and sacrifice of Isaac last time. Now tonight, similar thing, God delivers, God reveals and establishes and creates the covenant with Moses in Mount Sinai. And we are going to see tonight that again, now, not individually like it was with Abraham, but corporately as a nation, their faith will be put to the test. Do you believe that the God that fought for you here, that delivered you from this mighty Egyptian army, who said, "Stand by and watch me deliver you," is going to be able to take you and lead you into the promised land and drive out the big Anakim and all these tall giants that are living in the land? You believe it. First time around, Abram passed the test, right? This time around, what's the story going to be? Cliffhanger, right? You guys know the story. They're going to fail this test. It's going to take two tries for that to happen. And that's what we're going to look at tonight. Here's one way to think of the Pentateuch, right? These first five books of the Bible, and I believe it's fair to view these five books as really five pillars. They lay a foundation, a structure upon which the rest of the story will rest. Genesis, God's sovereignty and God's plan, crystal clear throughout the book of Genesis. In Exodus, we have God's charity, God's kindness, his gracious actions on behalf of his people, and we see his power. This is not a wimpy God. This is a mighty, powerful God. And it's seen not only in the Red Sea deliverance, but also in the Mount Sinai, where thunder and lightning and the very scene leads God's people to fear and trembling. And then in Leviticus, tonight, we're going to turn to God's sanctity, that God is holy, he is distinct, he is set apart from all other gods, all other things, all of creation. But we also see the person of God. God is not so transcendent that he is far. No, this is a God who is utterly holy and yet right in the midst of his people. So we see a personal God. Then in Numbers, we see the severity of God. Love this simple synopsis of the book of Numbers. Here it is. The desert has sand, and God has time. The desert has sand, and God has time. There's a lot of sand to bury the bodies, and God will wait until they trust. God's severity. God does not take sin lightly. He is not going to let a rebellious, obstinate people enjoy his blessing. No way, no how. And yet, we see the providence of God, right? Mercy and mighty, merciful and mighty, we sang tonight in that great hymn, Holy, Holy, Holy. Numbers illustrates it and lays it out for us. And then Deuteronomy, we see God's solemnity. We see the principles of God. God is holy, but God is for his people. God is determined to lead them into the land. So the five pillars, helping you see the connection between these five books that start the scriptures. So tonight, here's an overview of the three books we're going to look at in this first session together tonight. Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. In Leviticus, we have a holy people living with a holy God. What does that look like? What's the context? For most of you, if you've ever tried to read through the Bible in a year, this is kind of the demarcation zone. If you make it through here and you can get through the first 10 or 11 chapters of Numbers, you can pretty well make it all the way. But for a lot of you, you get lost in the wilderness here, and reading through the Bible kind of ends right about there. But Numbers, right? This is me trying to be a poet. I'm not very good, but a good wanderer makes the heart grow fonder, right? So Numbers, they're going to wander around in hopes that their heart will grow in its fondness toward God. And then in Deuteronomy, we get preparation for second chances. So this is Moses realizing he has a second generation, a new generation, perhaps some of whom saw the events of the Red Sea deliverance, Joshua and Caleb perhaps, but many of whom perhaps didn't even see Mount Sinai and weren't around for the golden calf and weren't around for some of those events. And so Moses is going to prepare this second generation to inherit and receive the blessing of the land God had promised. So that's what we're going to talk about. Just to give you a quick encouragement, right? In seminary, one of the exercises of torture that I had to do was an outline of the book of Leviticus that was creative. So here's the book of Leviticus. This thing's pretty busy. As I pulled this out, I was like, man, do I even include this? This thing has got stuff slapped all over it. But here's the idea. This was a picture in my head, looked better in my head than on here, of the camp of Israel, right? They've got their tents and they're laid out in a certain way. But in the center of the camp, right, is the tabernacle, the Holy of Holies. And so at the end of Exodus, right, the glory of the Lord fills the tabernacle, and you have this picture of a holy God tangibly manifest and present in the heart of his people. And so what does that mean? Well, that means there need to be some offerings. We got to deal with sin, and we got to prepare some servants that are going to keep up with the sin that's in the camp. And then, as God's glory is revealed, that now translates into how this community is going to relate to itself. So that was a bit busy, colorful way. Here's a little simpler, straightforward version of the book of Leviticus. And one other way of thinking of the book of Leviticus is to see it as God's handbook for holy living. God's handbook for holy living. The law that God has revealed at Mount Sinai contains three elements, three aspects. One is how man is to relate to God. But secondly, how is man to relate in worship, in community worship? It's the Sabbath, right? And then thirdly, how is man to relate to one another in society, in community? And so the Ten Commandments kind of break into those general categories. And then here, what we see is that God has various aspects to these instructions, his law. There is a ceremonial element, there's a societal element, and there's a corporate or a personal element. So this is an overview of the book of Leviticus. And you'll find in your notes, I'm not quite sure exactly what page it is in your notes, but you'll find there the outline and the main themes for the book of Leviticus. Now, Leviticus is written by Moses. It's probably written later. This is where, for Moses, he is going to be recording this after he comes off of the the mountain. This is written for the Exodus generation. So in a moment, we're going to shift to Numbers and then Deuteronomy. Those are written for the second generation. Leviticus is written primarily for that group of Israelites that experienced deliverance from Egypt. And it has a slightly narrower focus than just the general population, though Israelites as a whole would study and benefit from this book. But it's particularly written for this tribe of Levi that has been designated and set aside as the priests, those that would be God's mediators of the sacrifices of the way that the community would relate to God and to each other. And so that's the audience that's in view in the book of Leviticus. And some themes that we're going to see throughout Leviticus, God's holiness. There is sacrifice that is demanded for sin. We saw that back at the beginning of this story in Genesis 3, where sin enters the picture and it takes the death of an animal to make a covering for Adam and Eve, to cover the shame and their guilt. It took the blood, the sacrifice of an animal, to make payment, to make a covering. And so we're going to see that in various shades and fashions in the book of Leviticus. God's provision of atonement for sin. Leviticus kind of works in a pyramid fashion. You have the opening chapters, and chapter 16 is really the hinge in the book of Leviticus, because chapter 16 speaks of the Day of Atonement. And this is really the culmination of all the sacrifices, of all the ways that God is putting in place for the people to see their own sinfulness and to seek restoration, reconciliation with a holy God. And it's the Day of Atonement where two things happen, right? This animal is sacrificed, placed on an altar to make payment for the sins of Israel. But then there's a second animal upon whose head is placed all the sin of Israel, and he is released. He is sent out into the wilderness. This is where the scapegoat, right, comes from. Okay? And so all of this is happening in Leviticus 16. God gives his people the gift of atonement. Their sin is paid for, is driven away as far as the east is from the west. That goat leaves the camp, and it does not come back. Beautiful picture of what God is going to do for the sin and to the sin in the hearts and lives of his people. There's the revelation of God's law in all its detail and specificity. The temptation that we face today, right, because we wholly dismiss or ignore Leviticus as impractical, very irrelevant to a Christian today because of Jesus fulfilling the law, right? But what we miss in skipping over Leviticus or not paying careful attention to Leviticus is just how sinful we really are. God is driving home the point of don't think more highly of yourself than you ought, because that's going to be the temptation when God delivers you, when God does these mighty things on your behalf, when God clearly manifests and reveals himself, you're going to think you're pretty special, you're pretty good. And God says, be careful, right? When you think that the relationship is doing really well, what are you going to do? Get lazy, not focus on it, right? In any relationship that happens, have you ever seen that happen in a relationship that you've had, husbands, with friends, right? If that relationship, you feel a little overconfident and secure and you start taking things for granted, right? It's not long before that relationship starts to suffer decay and deterioration, and it's even harder to restore it. God, I believe, in Leviticus is making crystal clear how needy, how dependent his people need to be upon him. The main message, then, of Leviticus, here's my stab at it, it's in your notes there, would be this. God distinguishes his special people through the gracious revelation of the infinite gap separating a holy God from sinful people, right? So God is continuing to magnify, to expose this infinite gap between his holiness and the lives of this people that he has just redeemed. And through the provision of holiness, by means of substitutionary sacrifices, Okay? So God is distinguishing his special people in two ways, kind of helping you break down this long paragraph, right? One is through his gracious revelation, and the other is through the provision of holiness by means of substitutionary sacrifice. Now, can you hear the whisper in this story of a part of the story that's yet to come, of one who would be the tabernacle of God, the very revelation of God, because no one has ever seen God at any time. But this one is going to reveal him, and who, oh, by the way, will provide the holiness that God's people desperately need. And he will do it by means of a substitutionary sacrifice. And he will be the appointed mediator for God and his people. Oh boy, Leviticus just cries Messiah all the way throughout. You see how this story is connected? It's beautiful, beautiful. That's the book of Leviticus. Hopefully now if you're, it's like still February, right? I don't know if you're through Leviticus yet and read through the Bible, but hopefully I gave you just a little push to get you through it. Numbers. I said earlier, the desert has sand and God has time. That's one way of thinking of it. Here's another way. Purging the people in preparation for the land of promise. God is not afraid to trim the branches, to prune his people in order to bring a greater harvest of fruit down the road. The book of Numbers makes crystal clear that God is in the business of purging his people. Purging his people from faithless, lifeless rejection and rebellion of his glorious character and person, so that there will be a people, a remnant, a gathering that are prepared to enter and experience the rest, the inheritance of his promises. So Numbers starts with kind of a pack your bags, let's get ready for the journey. And oh, by the way, we're going to do a quick head count. Why the boring genealogies, boring from our vantage point, right, at the beginning of Numbers? Because as any good engineer would say, you measure at the start, you measure at the finish, and you look for the delta. In purging God's people, is the population going to diminish? The answer in the book of Numbers is no. The number of people that start this journey is going to look really, really similar to the number that finished this journey. But the faces change. The faces change. So God purging his people does not mean he's destroying his people. It doesn't mean that he is in any way going to diminish what he's doing, but rather it means he's refining. He's refining his people through the wandering and the difficulty of the wilderness. And in the same way that God's people wander in the wilderness through the book of Numbers for 40 years, those 40 years will point to one who will come later, spend 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, and will accomplish what this group failed to accomplish, and that is to not succumb to the temptations and trials that life in the wilderness will bring. So here's an overview of the book of Numbers. It's also a transition to new leadership. So as the journey begins, Moses is your leader. As the journey ends, Moses is no longer the leader of God's people. But God has a plan, a succession plan, that inaugurates Joshua as the new chosen leader for God's people. Now, as I mentioned earlier, if you just look quickly at the authorship composition, this is a later book, Numbers. This is written for the second generation of Israelites that have spent this 40 years in the wilderness. So this is written later in Moses' life, and it's written for that second generation that needed to hear and affirm, or excuse me, looking at Deuteronomy, that needed to be prepared for life in Canaan. They needed to be reminded of these painful lessons that their forefathers learned that led to 40 years in the wilderness. Because if you look at a map, right, there is no reason on the planet why you should spend 40 years getting from where they started at Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea and to the brink of the Jordan. I mean, you can make that journey pretty quick. And so if you're a second generation, why in the world have we been circling this wilderness for 40 years? Numbers has the answer, with a powerful message attached to it and a warning. Don't be like your forefathers. So here's the message then for the book of Numbers. God faithfully guides and grows his rebellious people through tempting times. So what is God up to? He is faithfully guiding them. He is faithfully growing them. But they are a rebellious lot. Through tempting times, by his holy discipline and direction, so that through faith they reach the place of rest and the enjoyment of his promised inheritance. God is so patient. So patient. And he is orchestrating and working and bringing judgment, bringing mercy and might to cultivate and begin to grow faith in the hearts of his people, a faith that will be imperative for them to receive the rest and inheritance of the land. And then Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is perhaps summed up this way: God's grip on Israel and his gracious call to affirm his covenant. One of the things that is very significant, you've perhaps heard this before about the Old Testament, is there is a consistent call, a consistent charge that God gives to his people to pass on from one generation to the next what they have received. And God kickstarted this process in the way he has dealt with his promises and plan with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Because Isaac and Jacob aren't necessarily trying to follow that plan. God is transferring his blessing, placing his covenant love upon them, and securing their destiny. So God models this in the creation of this family, this nation, from the very beginning. But now as it is a nation and this people set apart for him, he entrusts the stewardship of relationship with him, of all of the history, this rich history that they have with God, he entrusts that then to the fathers to teach to their children and to their children's children so that the message of this great and awesome God would be passed along. And a key part of that then that you'll see both in Moses and again in Joshua tonight is that as a father, as a leader, passes off the stage and enters into the other side of eternity, he makes crystal clear where his allegiance rests. His allegiance is to God, his covenant promises, and what God has called his people to be and to do. And then he says, now you follow after me. And that's what the book of Deuteronomy is all about. This is Moses saying, I am not going to experience the rest and promise of God because of my disobedience. Sin has serious consequences. You miss the blessing and rest of God. Now don't learn from my example. Go into the land, enjoy it, but be careful, be careful, be careful. Align your heart with God. That's the book of Deuteronomy. So again, Numbers and Deuteronomy are written about the same time. This is the need for this second generation to both hear God's covenant clearly laid out. So there's a part of this book that is very redundant in terms of Exodus and Leviticus, but that's because there are people who hadn't heard that message. And Moses wants to make absolutely certain they hear the message. And then there's the call for response. There's warnings, a blessing and cursing that come. And it concludes with the call to affirm and embrace this covenant God and relationship with Him. Just so that we don't get the wrong picture, Deuteronomy also wants to kind of put the final nail in the coffin of just how wicked our hearts are. And it's kind of like that final shot across the bow that when this generation experiences comfort, ease, wonderful blessing from God, that they don't begin to sell themselves on the lie that, hey, we deserved this. We deserve this. Look at us. How great. How glorious. God's planting firmly and clearly just how ugly and unfaithful their hearts really are with regard to His covenant. And yet, grace that is greater than all our sin, right? Grace, grace, God's grace is evident right in the midst of that. So here's the main message of Deuteronomy. God faithfully affirms His covenant commitment to His people and graciously prepares them to enjoy the realization of His promises. But He predicts future failure due to hearts that reject His grace. And here's where, even as they are about to realize God's promises to Abraham, God sends a clear message that says, just because you land and you receive all of this does not mean that the battle is over. You are going to fail. You are going to fail Me. And so the threat to God keeping His promises, the threat to God's rule and reign that we've seen right from the very beginning in Genesis 3, is still alive and well as this mighty nation is about to drive out inhabitants of the land and receive the promised inheritance. The threat to God's rule is alive and well. So that's an overview of those books thematically. Now I want to take just a half hour or so here. We'll break at about 7:30. And I want to take this, okay, and I give you this kind of outline as a guide that you can come back and study later, because here's what you're going to discover tonight, is in 30 minutes, what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and craft and put all of this into a fabric, a story, okay? I'm going to be flying high, selectively hitting points, all right? There is treasure upon treasure upon treasure. One of the battles that I have to fight every week is like, what do I cut and what do I keep? Because there is so much here. So take these notes, take this as helpful resources for you at some point down the road to go back through these books with a finer tooth comb. So let's take a look at this portion of the story. I'm calling it From Sand to Land, right? So they've left slavery, bondage in Egypt. They're in the sand of the wilderness. How are they going to get to the land? That's what this story answers. And just to emphasize, Brittany, what you shared earlier, and Alex, you as well, just look, this isn't in your notes, but open your Bibles. We're going to be in Leviticus, but just start in Genesis 15 for a second. Because remember, Genesis 15 is God establishing the covenant. He's promised things to Abraham in Genesis 12. Here in Genesis 15, He's formally ratifying the covenant. But in Genesis 15, 16 is a very important statement where God is casting forward the direction of this story. Because if we're asking the question, how are God's people going to get from the sand of the desert to the promised land of God's blessing, there's both a timing element to it, but there's also a a purity element to it, a judgment element to it. Look at verse 16 of Genesis 15. Then in the fourth generation, they will return here. So Abraham is in the land, but he has no possession of it. He's just wandering. In the fourth generation, they will return here. Notice they're not going to be there. They're going to have to return there. For the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. So God's blessing, God's gracious provision for Israel is simultaneously going to bring his holy, just punishment for the nations that are inhabiting this land. And God is patiently waiting for their sin to reach the point where his judgment comes, swift and hard. So this is setting the stage then for what we're moving toward. Because that statement in Genesis 15, 16 is going to get played out as we come to Deuteronomy. We're going to see that as we come to Deuteronomy, God is going to remind the people of Israel, listen, your entry into this land is not because you're righteous, not because you love me, not because you're faithful to the covenant. It is rather because I am committed to upholding my justice upon these nations, and I have chosen to use you as my instrument. Do not fool yourselves. And so Genesis 15, 16 is an important seed that's planted and will take root and grow and bloom in Deuteronomy. And later tonight, it'll really come into bloom in Joshua and Judges. All right, so let's look at Leviticus. And here on the road to reward, or from sand to land, I've tried to kind of put three main movements that really carry this story. One is the road to reward. Two is this idea of the enemy lurking in every heart and around every corner. Sin is alive within Israel, but sin is also alive in the hearts of the rest of the world and people that they're going to encounter and meet along the way. Characters like Balak and the Moabites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Icks and Ites and folks that they're going to encounter. And so this enemy is always lurking, always lurking. It's in every heart, but it's also around every corner. But then, at the very same time, in the very same breath, we see a gracious king who loyally loves disloyal subjects. A gracious king who loyally loves very disloyal, very rebellious subjects. So we left our story last time with this unsettling picture of God in all his holiness, majesty, power, revealing himself to Moses on Mount Sinai. And in the very midst of this powerful scene, what is Israel doing? Hey, Aaron, let's all throw our earrings in the fire, and poof, out comes a calf, right? And so idolatry, here's the point, idolatry, that evil heart is present right from the very beginning. This is a people that has seen God deliver powerfully out of Egypt through the Red Sea, and it is only a matter of months before they make their first idol and begin to establish worship of the created thing rather than the Creator. And idolatry, I think that's a powerful picture of foreshadowing of the great enemy that will plague God's people from this point in this story all the way throughout. That God's mighty act of deliverance is not going to, from a human vantage point at this stage in the story, is not sufficient. This miraculous, powerful demonstration, it's all on the outside, is not enough to secure their hearts. Even though it is miraculous, it is unbelievable, the the power and signs that God has shown them through the plagues and the deliverance. That is not enough to secure their heart affections. In fact, it doesn't even hold them for a couple months because idolatry enters the scene. And yet, in the midst of that idolatry, God gives Moses even greater clarity of revelation. And we hear that echo of God that resounds throughout the rest of the Old Testament. I am the Lord, gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, but abounding in steadfast, loyal love and truth. And I will by no means let the guilty go unpunished, right? Exodus 34, 6 and 7. The Psalms are filled with that message. The whole rest of the Old Testament is filled with that message of the glory of God in terms of his character. And so that has all been revealed. And now as we come to Leviticus, we see tangibly not just the holiness of God and the sanctity of his person, but how are his people going to walk? How are they going to live with a holy God in their midst? So God's personal presence then among the people calls for prescribed purity within the community. Leviticus, you might just flip to Leviticus chapter 11. As we saw earlier in the outline, the opening chapters highlight and lay out for us the various offerings and sacrifices that were needed for various offenses and for various celebrations where God's people would acknowledge his holiness. But Leviticus 11, 44 and 45 is very formative as we think of this road to God's reward in the land. And in Leviticus 11, 44 and 45, we read, "For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. You shall not defile yourselves with any swarming thing that crawls on the ground, for I am the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." Back in Exodus, we saw that God has established this people as a special possession. And so, as their affection for God grows, they are to grow in likeness and character to the image and character of God. So there's a prescribed purity that Leviticus points to. Leviticus chapter 7, verses 37 and 38. Flip back there with me. This is at the very end of these descriptions of sacrifices. We find this great summary statement. "This is the law of the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the sin offering, and the guilt offering, and the ordination offering, and the sacrifice of peace offerings, which the Lord commanded Moses at Mount Sinai in the day that he commanded the sons of Israel to present their offerings to the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai." So at this point in the story, God is saying, "I have prescribed for you a way to relate to me, a way to make reparation for your sin, a way to make restitution for your rebellion." Now, as he moves to the priests and these appointed servants that God had designated as the ones who would be his mediators, who would be administrating his grace through these sacrifices, through these offerings, we also find that God's holiness is a consuming fire. His holiness is no joke. This is not something that you are to take flippantly, lightly. It is all-consuming and can destroy you in an instant. And we see here very early on something that will be a pattern throughout this story, that as God is forming and calling and refining his people, there will inevitably be one instance early on where they test God and say, "Is he really going to do what he said he's going to do?" So, I have kids, right? This is like one of those things that as a parent you come to kind of learn and realize that these crucial moments you can kind of either make life easy or hard for yourself. So if you make a threat to your child that says, okay, if you lip off one more time, this is what's going to happen. If you do that, you say that, articulate that, right, and they lip off and you don't do it, oh man, you have just sown the seeds of rebellion for a long, long time, and it will be very hard to reel them back in. God doesn't do that, right? So Nadab and Abihu decide that they're going to kind of test the waters of what they can get away with and how flippantly they can take this role that God has given them. And what happens? God strikes them dead instantly in an act of judgment, but it sends a message to his people that says, my justice is serious. I do not take lightly my holiness. And so there is very early in this story the reminder that God is holy. Now, not only is there Nadab and Abihu, I've listed here in your notes Leviticus chapter 9, and I think this is powerful as well. This is a positive picture of God as a consuming fire. So after instructing and prescribing how the priests were to purify themselves and prepare to offer sacrifices, they do it. And in Leviticus 9, just turn there to verse 22 and through 24, Aaron lifts up his hands toward the people and he blesses them, and he stepped down after making the sin offering and the burnt offering, and the peace offerings. And then Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting. And when they came out and blessed the people, the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. But notice this, verse 24, then fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the portions of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces, right? God strikes worship and fear into the hearts of his people through this sacrifice. And it's after that Nadab and Abihu still decide to test God and his holiness. Not only, though, is God's holiness seen as a consuming fire in Leviticus, but we see that God provides the purity and forgiveness his people need through blood sacrifice. Through blood sacrifice. So there are laws and regulations, but again, as I mentioned earlier, chapter 16 is really the pivot in the book of Leviticus. And as God is preparing this Exodus generation, this first generation, for life with him, life in community with a holy God right in the center, atonement is pivotal. And so we see the message of atonement, the sacrifice of one goat that would pay for the sin of Israel, and then the laying on of hands on another goat that would be driven outside the camp. In Leviticus 17, verse 11, then, has a powerful summary statement of the essential nature of blood. Leviticus 17:11 says, for the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood by reason of life that makes atonement. This is a very powerful, necessary teaching that, again, whispers to God's ultimate provision of atonement in one who would come in this seed that will crush the head of the serpent. So blood sacrifice is essential, and God's holiness then brings peace for those who honor it and destruction for those who ignore it. Flip to Leviticus chapter 26 and look at verse 11. Moreover, God says, I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul will not reject you. I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. What a sweet picture of relationship. God takes them by the hand. So I'm going to be among you. I'm going to walk with you. I'm going to be your God. You will be my people. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt so that you would not be their slaves. And I broke the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect. But if you do not obey me and do not carry out all these commandments, if instead you reject my statutes, if your soul abhors my ordinances so as not to carry out all my commandments and break my covenant, then I'll bring terror, a sudden terror over you, verse 16, consumption and fever that will waste away the eyes. I will cause your soul to pine away. You will sow your seed uselessly, for your enemies will eat it up. I'll set my face against you. And so there's judgment, right? There is a penalty. There is a consequence for rejecting this gracious, kind, tender relationship that God has with his people. And that's the book of Leviticus. It's the preparation. It's the provision of God for his people. And so as this first generation, we're going to see later, gets ready to go into the promised land, with this in view, how will they respond? And that's where we turn then to Numbers, to the book of Numbers. And though Numbers is written primarily to the second generation, it explains why there's a need for the second generation, why they will be the ones primarily and predominantly to enter into the land. Now, I've listed there in your notes the account and summary of the population of this people of Israel at the beginning of this part of the story and the end. And you'll notice there's only about a 2,000 person difference, less than 2,000 person difference, from beginning to end. So from within the first year to year 40, only 2,000 people are actually removed from the total headcount of this nation, which in the total scope of things, I didn't run the math, it's less than 1%, right, of these people. It's like 0.3%. That's remarkable. God's judgment is preserving while it purges. And so the point there is God's discipline preserves as it purges sin from his people. Now I want to highlight a couple of key parts to this story in Numbers, because you picture this people, they're walking with God. As Numbers begins, they're on the move. So up until this point in the story, they've been stationary. Everything in Exodus and Leviticus is happening at Mount Sinai. They aren't mobile yet. But now in Numbers, pack your bags, boys. Time to move, right? So they're mobile. They're moving. They're literally walking with God as their leader. How's that going to go? What's going to happen? Well, Numbers 13 is really a key chapter. You have these genealogies and the establishment of leadership for this people. But it's in Numbers 13. And of course, there's lots of grumbling and complaining, which is kind of the classic pattern of life in the wilderness. That never happens in your life, does it? When provisions are low and not sure how things are going to actually play out, you're just like, oh, yes, I know you'll provide, God. I sure don't. I tend to be like, man, why do I have to work this hard? Why does it have to be this difficult? Why do I have to do the same things over and over and over again? Sound just like them. So it's in the midst of that that God says, all right, here you go. You've had your fill of manna. You've had your fill of walking around on sandy land. Go into the land. Go check it out. Numbers 13. Scope it out. See what you think. See if I'm trustworthy on this, that this is going to bless your socks off. And so they go into the land. And of course, this is true democratic fashion, right? You got 12 tribes, 12 little independent related parties, send one delegate from each tribe, go in. Moses says, you guys come back, and of course we're going to take a 12-man vote, see what we should do. Go in or hold back. And so, you know how the story goes, right? They go into the land, all the grapes, the fruit, it's remarkable. Oh, by the way, who do they meet
when they get into the land. Certain woman's name. What's her name? You guys haven't talked for like an hour and a half. Come on. You know who this is, right? She's not a very prominent. Okay. It's Rahab, but that's coming later. Sorry, I jumped ahead. I've got this in Joshua. No wonder you guys are sitting there like, what is he talking about? Rahab's coming later. Sorry. So they go into the land, and the spies spy out the land, and they come back. And I put here in your notes, Numbers 13. So we have 12 men. They come back. Now what's the ratio? 10 to 2? 10 say, too big, too strong, don't do it. 2, Joshua and Caleb say, no, the Lord will do this. We will surely overcome. Well, in verse 32, excuse me. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report. A bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone and spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people who we saw in it are men of great size. And we saw the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight. This is terrible. Right, surely God has brought, this has been like their constant cry, right? God has brought us to this point to destroy us, right? This is just some big sham. He's kept us all this time, but really he just wants to destroy us in some new and cruel way. And so these Nephilim who make us look like grasshoppers is his latest tactic. So who does Moses and who do the people listen to? 2 or the 10? Peer pressure at its finest, right? They listen to the 10. And so, as we saw in that overarching storyline, God has blessed his people with deliverance. They have believed, they've responded in faith, and God has revealed more of how to relate to him. And he is now moving them toward the realization of the promise, the realization of his blessing. And yet, they, when tested, prove that their faith is faulty, it's shallow, it's weak. And so they don't go in. And as a result, they're going to suffer and languish in the wilderness for 40 years. Sobering picture. I'll share just a neat story of how God used that passage in my life, and really it's a testimony of my wife and God's work in her heart. We were wrestling with, do we go to seminary or not? Do we leave this job at Caterpillar or not? What do we do? And we just weren't sure. We were not quite on the same page, not on the same wavelength. But I'll never forget, I got a phone call at work. And it was Amy, and she said, we need to go to seminary. I said, oh, why? She said, well, I was listening to some message on Numbers 13, and she said, I realized that God has this rest, this blessing, but if we don't have faith, we're going to miss the blessing and rest of God. And so I don't know what he has for us, but it seems like I need to have faith that he's going to do something when we go. So let's go. It's like, okay. Didn't get much clearer than that, Lord. Here we go. Faith is a crucial element to receive, enjoy God and the relationship that he sustains and offers. So this is the first sign that all is not well with this generation of people who had seen mighty, mighty acts, right? If you ever say, boy, if I could have just seen God, or just, you know, do you ever ask yourself that? Like, how in the world, if you saw him part the Red Sea, the Egyptian bodies on the shore, this mountain that's quaking and filled with thunder. And Numbers 15. But the person who does anything with a high hand, this is verse 30, whether he is a native or a sojourner, reviles the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from among his people, because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment. That person shall be utterly cut off. His iniquity shall be on him. The true colors are starting to come out in Numbers 15. After Numbers 13, we start to see greater rebellion. High-handed means defiant, in your face, God, I am rejecting you type rebellion. And so then when we come to Numbers 21, this people is sinning left and right. And Numbers 21, verses 7 through 9 are listed there in your notes. The people come to Moses, right? And they say, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. So there's an illustration of this high-handedness. Pray to the Lord that he may take away the serpents from us. Don't miss this in the story, that God in this relationship, he's secured it through deliverance, and he is defining it through his gracious revelation and communication to his people, not because that will prevent them from sin, but so that when sin comes, who are they going to run to? Who are they going to call out for mercy? Who are they going to come to? And Numbers 21 is a great example of that, because they say, pray to the Lord that he may take these serpents that were his judgment for their rebellion from us. So Moses prays for the people. And the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent, set it on a pole, and everyone who is bitten when he sees it shall live. So Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on a pole. And if a serpent bit anyone, he would look at the bronze serpent and live. This is a great little story tucked in the middle of this book that again whispers of the one who would be lifted up, who would be nailed to a piece of wood, lifted up so that all who would look upon him might have life. Here in Numbers 21, it's physical life. I mean, the serpent bites you, you're dead, like, bam. And God says, put that bronze serpent on a pole. If you look at that serpent, you'll live. Now, that sounds absurd from a human standpoint. But this is God saying, will you trust me? Will you put faith in me? Later on, his Messiah will hang from a tree. And his own people would say, cursed is the one who hangs on the tree. And God would say, he's the one that will bear the curse for you if you would look upon him and live. The desert has sand, God has time, and he has his bogey set squarely on the hearts of his people. He's going to teach them, he's going to train them to trust and follow him, and to take very seriously what it means to walk with him, not away from him. So we come then to the cusp of receiving the promise in Deuteronomy. And God's people are there. They're ready to receive it. And so Deuteronomy then is Moses' passionate plea to the people. It is God crying loyal love to his disloyal subjects. And the first series of chapters are just loaded. Deuteronomy 6, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. Worship him only. It's a call to fidelity, to a singularity of worship, devotion, love, and affection. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, all your might, and teach that to your kids, right? Deuteronomy 6, Deuteronomy 8. Remember, God says, as you look back, as you reflect on 40 years of wandering, realize that your hearts are like magnets. I have a polarity that is fixed. It never changes. But when your heart is set a certain way and the polarity is off, you cannot draw near to me. It actually repels you from me.
And I've put you in that wilderness so you would see how fickle your heart is, going from a polarity of magnet that would draw you to me to a polarity that pushes you away from me. And that it's the polarity of your hearts that is pivotal in this. I don't change. I'm the same. But where's your heart? Where's your heart? And what's its polarity toward me? Deuteronomy 8 then says, "You shall remember all the way that I've led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that I might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart." What's the point of the story up to this point? Why 40 years wandering? That God would humble them, teaching them to depend upon Him, but He would expose the polarity of their hearts, whether you would keep His commandments or not. He humbled you and He let you be hungry, Deuteronomy 8:3 says, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that He might make you understand. Here's what God's been driving at all through the wilderness, that man cannot live on bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Thus you are to know in your heart that the Lord your God was disciplining you just as a man disciplines his son. Therefore, keep the commandments of the Lord, walk in His ways, and fear Him. It's an old familiar message, but it's being put in motion again to the second generation. Why is it so important that we realize we cannot live by bread alone? Especially when God is about to bring them into a lavish, comfortable, very cozy place. It's easy to know that you don't live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God when you've got to wake up every morning and you get enough for one day. You get enough for one day. If you even try to scrimp and save, it goes bad, right? So for 40 years, God's been conditioning and preparing and prepping them to receive His blessing and not get fat and happy and forget Him. But look at verse 10 in Deuteronomy 8. When you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which He has given you. But beware, verse 11, that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping His commandments, His ordinances, and His statutes, which I am commanding you today. Otherwise, when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, when your herds and your flocks multiply, your silver and your gold multiply, and all that you have multiplies, here's the danger. 21st century American, hear this danger. Then your heart will become proud, and you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. We have a really hard time handling God's blessing. Really hard time. Because we are a wretchedly forgetful people. And if this is the culmination of the first five books, this is the message it's sending loud and clear. That when God's blessing reaches a peak at that particular time, God's people are most vulnerable, most susceptible, most likely to rebel. I've included chapter 9 there in your notes. God doesn't beat around the bush when it comes to why they're going to inherit the land. Look at chapter 9, verse 4. Do not say in your heart, right? He doesn't say they're going to verbalize this necessarily. But do not say in your heart, when the Lord your God has driven them out, these nations, before you, because of my righteousness, the Lord has brought me in to possess this land. Note to self, when God brings blessing to your life, have you ever heard a little voice inside say, I deserve this. Look at this. I've been faithful, God. I deserved this. Thank you. Thank you for rewarding me
and what I've done. These guys had that problem too. Because of my righteousness, the Lord has brought me in to possess this land, God says, but it is because of the wickedness of these nations that I'm dispossessing them before you. It is not for your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you're going to possess their land. It's because of the wickedness of these nations that I'm going to drive them out in order to confirm the oath which I swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Note Genesis 15, 16. God's keeping his promise. He's not honoring the faithfulness of his people here. Know then, verse 6, it's not because of your righteousness that the Lord is giving you this good land to possess. Why? For you are a stubborn people. And then he says, if you want to just take that for a minute, let me recount for you just a few of the highlights of your stubbornness. Summed up at the end of verse 7 with, you have been rebellious against the Lord. That's who you are. You are rebels, not righteous. But God is a gracious king that loyally loves his disloyal subjects. And I want to cue you into two whispers here in Deuteronomy that find glorious expression later in the story. Deuteronomy 18. In the midst of that dark backdrop, in Deuteronomy 18, talking about prophets, the Lord says to Moses, they are right in what they have spoken. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And whoever will not listen to my words, that he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. Prophet like you. There's going to be a prophet who's also going to be a priest, who's also going to be a king that's going to come one day. And he will speak not his own words. What I see my father doing, that's what I do. What I hear my father saying, he will say, that's what I say. And I myself will require it of him if you reject that voice. But then, see, all throughout this wilderness wandering, all throughout this opening chapter, or chapters, if you will, in this story, sin is just constantly destroying and undermining and subverting God's rule and reign over his people. How is that going to be resolved? How is that enemy going to be conquered? And toward the end of Deuteronomy, in chapter 30, we see a beautiful, beautiful picture. Look at verse 6 of Deuteronomy chapter 30. And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, that you may live. You see, what he had commanded back in Deuteronomy 6 was impossible for them. Impossible for them. And it's impossible for us, apart from God's gracious intervention. So God says this heart problem, this stubbornness, this rebellion is going to be overturned. It's going to be undone. I am going to circumcise your heart. Now, that's a pretty crude, rough picture. But as we watch in this story, it's going to get clearer and clearer and clearer. So as we come to the end of Deuteronomy then, we have this man, Moses. Now don't miss this. Moses, 120 years old, but notice what it says in verse 7 of Deuteronomy 34. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. You know what God's saying? Moses did not enter the land because he was physically deficient at all. Moses wasn't too old for battle. Moses wasn't too wimpy to go and conquer in the land. No, this man was ready to fight. But God sat him down because of his disobedience. God's discipline wasn't a slow fade for Moses. He had to see, look at the blessing of God with all the strength and energy that would have been necessary to enjoy it and not taste it, not touch it, not experience and enjoy it as a consequence for one choice back earlier in the story. And so it's a clear reminder, right, to God's people that says you're going to experience a transition in leadership, and I'm going to sovereignly, graciously superintend that. It's going to go well. But don't forget this leader that should have been with you but is not. Let's take a break, and it wasn't even close to 7:30. Let's take about a 10-minute break, so a little after 8, we'll get started on the second half here.